Are you tired of feeling tired? Do you wish you could turn back the clock on aging? NT-Factor Lipids is the breakthrough supplement that's scientifically proven to repair and renew your body's cells. NT-Factor Lipids are identical to the phospholipids found in your cellular membranes. They've been shown to repair mitochondrial damage, a primary cause of biological aging. In clinical trials, NT-Factor therapy resulted in a 26.8% increase in mitochondrial function, restoring it to levels found in young adults. NT-Factor has also been shown to reduce fatigue by up to 43% and has even been shown to significantly reduce a wide range of symptoms and improve the quality of life in patients with various conditions like chronic fatigue and those undergoing chemotherapy. I've been using NT-Factor for years and prescribe it for my patients. You can find the NT-Factor line of nutritional formulas at your favorite health food store or online retailer. Or, to order direct, call 800-982-9158, 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com. That's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today, we're going to talk about migraine headaches, a very, very challenging problem. There are a new raft of drugs out there that purport to treat migraines, but migraines continue to be a problem because they offer only partial relief, sometimes with side effects. It has been my belief for a long time that there is a nutritional concomitant to migraines. There's a migraine diet, the classic migraine diet that offers relief to some. But today's guest has taken it to a very high level with really a form of precision nutrition. She's Angela Stanton. She has a lot of academic credentials. She's a PhD, an MS, Masters of Science. She has an MBA. She's a Bachelor's of Science. She has an academic career. And she also has a Bachelor of Science in Mathematics. Her doctoral research focused on understanding how human decision-making is influenced by neurotransmitter changes. And that is germane to the discussion because we believe that neurotransmitters have a lot to do with susceptibility to migraines. She herself is a migraine sufferer. And so she has a personal stake in this. In 2008, she took early retirement from her academic career and has become an avid researcher on the subject of migraines. The result is that in 2017, she published the second edition of the book, Fighting the Migraine Epidemic, A Complete Guide, How to Treat and Prevent Migraines Without Medicines, that put her front and center as a leader in the field of migraine research based on nutritional and electrolyte management. And she now teaches migraine sufferers and healthcare providers all over the world about how to abort and prevent migraines free of medication. So I'm very, very excited to talk to you and to hear your insights. So welcome, Dr. Stanton. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hoffman, for inviting me. I'm looking forward to our discussion. Here.
Indeed. Tell us a little bit about your personal journey, because you yourself are a migraine sufferer. So you had an opportunity to do research and to do trial and error, and you were kind of a guinea pig for some of the principles that you espouse.
Correct. I was the guinea pig, I should say that, for many, many years. I started migraines when I was very early teen. I was not yet teen, 10, 11, something in that region. And of course, those are not really migraines the way people define migraine. They were more cyclical vomiting syndrome, irritable bowel syndrome, and they were sort of seasonal. And at that time, of course, nobody understood that it had anything to do with migraines. So they just thought, well, I probably had some stomach infection from eating fruits and vegetables, maybe some bacteria, something like that, which would be common. But because it was seasonal and because it was always present, in retrospect, now I could see that what I really had were childhood presentations of migraines. So I started relief very early. And I can say this with more confidence now that I work with a lot of parents whose children in their early teens, some even younger, down to 3 or 4 years old, have this presentation. And that seems to be migraine in response to the protocol that I have created. So,
there's sort of a spectrum of migraine symptoms. For example, there's some people have ocular migraines where they have visual phenomena shimmering, but without actual headaches, but these in effect are possibly the same physiology. There's some people who have full bore classic migraines. I think it comes from the French hemicrane, half of the head. So it's only on one side. But associated with nausea, vomiting sometimes as a prelude to the attack. But there are some people, and I've actually had some of these people in my practice, who have what is termed visceral migraines with predominantly cyclic vomiting and gastrointestinal symptoms, right? So it's all correct. Part of the same constellation of symptoms.
It is, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about this. And you mentioned the aura migraine versus the non-aura migraine, a classic migraine. And so it's very good that you brought that up, because in my later understanding, once I really deeply dug into the science itself, and when I'm talking about the science, digging into the science, I left the field of migraine research, because what the migraine research actually is basically trying to just find medication to reduce the headache. Mm-hmm. And the nausea that comes with migraines. But it really isn't the kind of research that I wanted to do. I wanted to understand.
So you're saying that these are what are called ameliorative therapies. They address the symptoms, but they're not root cause therapies.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so the root cause is very complicated. And so not too many people dove into them. Now, when I'm saying this with caution, because I found a ton of literature on migraine, except they were not part of what we call the migraine literature. They may have been physics, chemistry, biology, the very basics, the biochemistry, electrophysiology, cardiology. I mean, you go through all the different fields and you find connection. So basically what I did was reading all these literature and having a very mathematical and physics background and very strong in chemistry, I had an easier way to sort of see through the connections, to find the connection. And then this took me about 15 years of work, by the way. It's not like an easy thing to literally, first of all, to find these articles and to know that these articles actually even exist and they have anything to do with migraine. And here my own experience with migraine comes into factor, because I could associate with certain things thinking that, oh, this may have something to do with what I'm experiencing. So let's see if it does or if it doesn't. And so I ran into it with a very open mind to see what may or may not connect. And then once I had these literally thousands of literature, reading anything from how many voltage-gated sodium channels there are at a particular spot in a particular neuron versus how electrolytes move in the body, what may be the cause of the aura, for example, how come that an aura migraineur may or may not have a migraine associated with a headache, et cetera. So once I was able to understand the connection, then I cannot tell you with quite high accuracy, and also because I have nearly 18,000 migraine members currently in my Facebook migraine group, that just about everybody has some sort of visual symptoms with migraine. It's just that they are not recognized equally to a formal aura, which would be very beautifully colorful, looking like the aura borealis, similar mm-hmm. kind of a visualization, or it could be black and white zigzag, but they're very typical. But there are the more, I guess they refer to as synsynaptic scotomas, but those are visual disturbances that are equivalent in their cause to the aura. And whether a person has a visualization of an actual aura will depend upon the direction of where what is referred to as the cortical spreading depression heads. And I don't know to what depths you would like to get into the biophysiology and the pathophysiology of migraine.
It clearly is something going on in the brain, and it is in some ways seizure-like, I think, an analogy to seizures. And we know that in seizures, there's electrical disruption, chaotic electrical impulses. From what I understand about brain physiology, the neurons are finely tuned They have membrane depolarization, neurotransmitters act on them, but things can go haywire. And that's where your understanding of physiology came in to understand why some people have jittery neurons. By oversimplifying it?
No, you're not. I think that I'm very happy that you have said seizure, because I just published an academic article defining migraine a little bit better. And I, in fact, say that it is a seizure. What differs is purgation of the electrical activity in the brain that precedes it. But basically, seizure and migraine are exactly the same in terms of pathophysiology. The same things cause it. But what differs is that in the case of a seizure, it's a hyperstimulation of all the neurons associated with that particular region at once. And so it sort of goes off like a bomb, the way I visualize. Whereas in a migraine, there's no hyperstimulation. The problem is the lack of ability to undo the stimulation. So it's the inhibition problem. But
in other words, to slow the cascade, because like once you start, you're off to the races.
Yeah. But the cascade itself, as a result of that, because of the way that the migraine propagates differently, rather than a sudden explosion of all the neurons associated with that particular region, the brain, the way I visualize it, is almost like it's trying to create its own CPR in that to restart the brain properly. And so it is well understood that there is a depolarization before a migraine, and the depolarization starts in one spot, and that one area releases sodium in order to depolarize the brain. And that sodium moves through the brain. I believe the speed is about 2.5 millimeter per minute, covering slowly in a wave-like manner every single neuron. And so this is referred to as cortical splitting depression.
It's like a sodium avalanche in a way.
Very well put. It's a sodium avalanche. So the brain is understanding that it is stuck in one spot. The message is arriving that a particular brain region is not working. Some neuron, maybe one, maybe 10, maybe a million, I don't know, aren't working. And the reason why they aren't working is obviously they aren't communicating. So in the brain, all communication is by electricity. And the electricity requires the sodium to enter the neuron to generate the action potential, which is then the electricity that then moves to the next particular opening in that neuron.
Can we just come up, back up a little bit and make the distinction between regular tension headaches, you know, people wake up and they have a headache, and maybe it's a caffeine withdrawal headache, or maybe it's a stress-related neck tension is causing problems, versus a migraine? Or are they on a continuum where perhaps some people with bad headaches have some features of migraines, but they're not classic migraines?
No, because migraine is genetic. So you can have a headache, mm-hmm. but you can't have a migraine if you don't have a different brain. And this different brain, just like in seizures, is presented by a stimulus problem. So if you and I, and if you're not a migraineur, if you and I go into the same room, mm-hmm. I will see a completely different world around me than you will, because I have a lot more sensory neuronal connection than you do.
Okay.
And this is a genetic, it's not really an atavism, it's a lack of genetic adaptation, and it's associated with our inability to inhibit signals. Mm-hmm. And so the migraine brain is anatomically different. It has a lot more connections between sensory neurons. Not the more neurons, just more connections. So there's more chatter.
Are we at the point where we can do like a saliva test and submit it for a genetic analysis and come up with the series of SNPs that predispose to migraines, or is that futuristic?
I think it's futuristic simply because if I'm looking at the human genome database, then I see nearly 4,000 variants. Now, the first three are the most complex variants that are the most associated with migraine, and those are the voltage-gated channels in the brain, sodium, potassium, and then the ATPase pump, which takes the sodium, potassium, and balances it back up. And so to look at just for these three receptors, given that the problem is in the brain specifically, it's not elsewhere, even though these are the same minerals that are popular elsewhere in the body, it would be very difficult to do. So I don't see a saliva or a blood test, but I do see an EEG, perhaps, which you are familiar with. It's a cap they put on, and you get a lot of electrodes which then can see the movement of the electricity in the brain. And with that, they can tell whether the person has a migraine.
And by the way, you are an expert. You have certification or advanced training in what's called functional MRIs. Does the brain of a person with migraines light up differently than a, quote, normal brain?
It probably does. And I wish I had the experience to run some experiments, but I haven't, because of my field at that time was so much focused on neurotransmission itself, and very specifically certain neurotransmitters. And so I did not even think of running migraine experiments. And of course, now it would be great if it could. And I think that it could. Although in terms of fMRI, the functional part of it, you would have to put a person into a very narrow tube that is very loud and have them literally watch a computer screen or listen to something to generate a migraine. And to generate a migraine is a very painful process. And I'm not sure that an ethical board would go with that.
Yeah, that's a good point. So look, there have been migraine diets for as long as I've been in medical practice, and probably long before. And they tell you to avoid typical potential migraine triggers. I'm sure you've been there, done that personally, and you've worked with patients who've been there, done that, with either no relief or only partial relief. What's wrong with the so-called migraine diet that is classically administered to people going to migraine clinics? So before they, you know, do medication and all this kind of stuff, they'll say, oh, you really should be on the migraine diet.
Okay, well, there's some good things in it and there are some bad things in it. The good thing is that some of the foods that are high in sugar, for example, if the classic migraine diet consider removing the sugar element, that's definitely helpful. But there's no understanding by those diets of why something is a trigger. And so if I'm looking at a trigger, there's only one trigger. And that trigger is that whatever you eat or drink or do, that causes an electrolyte imbalance and a reduction of sodium from the place where it should be in your brain to start an electricity. Anything that you do that affects the population of the sodium in your neuron region to start an electricity is a trigger. It doesn't need to be food. And so when we're looking at, some people will say, okay, the most typically known migraine trigger, for example, is MSG. MSG, right? But there are two problems with this. First of all, nobody eats MSG on its own. So what you put it on may be the trigger. It just so happens that MSG comes with it. But also, what is MSG? MSG is taking a salt molecule of sodium and chloride and breaking it apart and using only sodium and dumping the chloride and replacing it with an amino acid, glutamate, right?
Which has a neurotransmitter potential because it's an excitatory neurotransmitter.
It's an excitatory neurotransmitter. Exactly. That's the point I'm coming to. Glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter. And salt, sodium is essential for a neuron generating electricity. Mm-hmm. But chloride has to be on the outside because chloride is a negatively charged. And we're not getting into deep chemistry here. But negative and positive charges have to work together in order to maintain some sort of an order of what the particular chemical is supposed to be doing. And so here, we removed the chloride from the sodium and we partnered it with an excitatory neurotransmitter. And then we're looking as, oh, well, it's a migraine trigger. It's not a migraine trigger. It just caused the biggest problem because it's causing both an electrolyte problem by only having sodium and not chloride. Plus, it is an excitatory neurotransmitter and migraineurs have a problem with inhibiting. And so you're adding more to the fire with an excitatory neurotransmitter. So it is not a trigger. It is a chemical connection to causing the kind of excitatory action in the brain and the electrolyte imbalance that you want to avoid. But the problem is also what you're putting it on that makes it more susceptible. So if you just simply sat down and you ate a teaspoon of MSG on its own, you may not have a problem because you have other chemicals with which in your stomach, for example, the sodium and the glutamate can partner. So we have to also look at what kind of barn, the kind of food that we're eating or drinks that we're drinking will create in our body as it reaches the particular location where it's heading to.
When you think of electrolyte imbalances in migraine, there has been some classic work looking at magnesium as kind of a shall we say, inhibitory or balancing electrolyte that has kind of a calmative effect. You know, sometimes used for anxiety, it's used to help people sleep. Does magnesium figure into the picture at all?
It does, but not the way that she imagined. It's really interesting that migraineurs have a complete opposite response to magnesium. So rather than being calming, it is actually excitatory. And to understand why this is, I went in to look at the function of magnesium.
Yeah.
And it's many, many functions, but one of the functions very specific to the brain is that in order for this, the voltage-gated channels, and we have many, we have sodium, potassium, calcium, these are all voltage-gated channels. That means that an energy, ATP, is used to open them. And in order for the ATP to literally attach to the gate, magnesium is the one that's taking it to the gate. And so it allows...
ATP is magnesium dependent. That's the energy currency of the body.
And so it's connecting to the gate to get it open. So if you're taking magnesium, then the gates are going open, 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 open.
Okay.
And so then the excitation is going to be even more difficult to inhibit. And so whereas magnesium is really helping a lot of people sleep, if a migraineur takes magnesium, we have nightmares.
I see. Okay, well, maybe that's why magnesium doesn't relieve migraines so readily. So the conclusion we can draw from this is that sodium plays a role here. So does that call for a low-sodium diet? People should avoid it, or people should encourage their... I'm not sure what the practical import of that is.
Yeah, this was a long time for me to also figure out. But this came with my experimenting on myself. So as you mentioned at the beginning, I was my own guinea pig.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order for me to understand what actually was needed here, I started to take salt just on its own. Mm-hmm. Like in the morning, I would get up and before I eat or drink anything, I would take a little salt at a time, small pinch with a little water and see what happened. And for my biggest amazement, it always made my migraine disappear without exception.
As
of course,
an antidote to migraines, even when they were in the process of developing.
Exactly. And so at that time, I didn't yet have my food changed or any changes. Just wanted to understand this one thing. So I tried to make changes this one thing at the time. And when I discovered the salt thing, and I called it the salt thing because I had no better way for it. And at that time, we had a person living with us who helped my mother, who was elderly at the time. I needed mercy care. And that nurse also had migraines. And so she saw me taking salt and she said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm trying to prevent my migraine here. I'm taking salt every morning first thing before I eat or drink anything. So she started doing it and her migraines disappeared too. I said, wow, just me. So this continued. This was about 13 years ago. And so then I continued my research along the lines and I understood that what I needed was massively more salt.
Wow.
Massive.
Which is counterintuitive because we tend to demonize salt. A lot of people who are virtuous are on very low salt diets. Does it also have anything to do with hydration? Because sometimes hydration is a factor that promotes or relieves headaches.
Very correct. And I have to add here is that not all migraines come with a headache. So you may have a migraine without a headache. And it's still a migraine, right? And so the salt is still going to help you. So the headache is coincidental. It's just basically helping you identify what you have, but you don't need a headache. With this said and done, dehydration can cause headache and migraine is no different. It can come with a headache. So the headache part is in fact very much so caused by dehydration. And by dehydration, don't just understand not drinking enough. Some people drink too much water and they dilute their electrolyte in their blood and that too causes dehydration. And some people go as far as drinking distilled water. I mean, they purify the water, but water
has no minerals. Yeah.
No minerals. And that's really bad for you because water is a solvent. And not only that is really bad for you, but because water is a solvent, it's charged both negative and positive, is a dipolar element. If you put salt into water, it actually ties down some of the electrical charge. Not all of it. It still remains a little bit charged, but it actually takes away much of it. And so it reduces the water's ability to be a solvent. And so it becomes much more calming for the body to take water with salt in it. And so this was the original idea that I had. And again, it's very chemically complex and most people are not thinking yeah. the way that I'm thinking.
This is where your background in physics and chemistry and mathematics
exactly.
come in.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's all sort of kind of collided for me to understand that I can sort of kind of neutralize the chemical solvent effect of water by putting a little bit of salt into it. Now, how much salt I need to put into it, that's another question, and that can vary based on the person. But I have come to, based on my experience, that about 1/8 of a teaspoon of salt, which is about 750 milligram salt, 300 milligram sodium.
It's not that much.
It have been just the perfect amount to tolerate, to take also, because salt is emetic. It can mm-hmm. make people vomit. And so it actually makes me vomit. So I then created electrolyte capsule, which is salt basically in veggie cap with or without iodine. And that makes it easier for those who end up responding to the emetic nature of salt in a bad way. But it seemed to, I found after years and years of research that a 1/8 teaspoon of salt was just about the right amount to stop a migraine in its track and also to prevent one. So ever since, every single morning, I will wake up and I will take my salt and water, and I haven't had a migraine.
Mm-hmm.
Or I can create one if I take a day and I'm not going to take it. Salt and water, I'm going to end up with a migraine.
So is that it? Because you also have written extensively about the potential for ketogenic diet to help migraine. And right. you're not the only pioneer who's exploring that. Unfortunately, there's not that much research because ketogenic diet is a little bit considered, there's kind of a war against keto in the nutrition field. They think it's, it may relieve your symptoms, but it'll kill you. That kind of feeling about keto. But keto can be an adjunct to the sodium treatment.
Right. You're probably familiar with the research on how a keto diet is helping seizures. So mm-hmm. if you're looking yes. at migraine as a form of a seizure, then you can see the connection. But the other connection with all the good and bad about ketogenic and also carnivore, mind you, carnivore is even better for migraine than the ketogenic.
Carnivore is superior to keto.
Carnivore is superior. Okay. And I will explain why that is. But so the reason behind both of these diets and even low carb, high fat, which is just simply reduced carbohydrates, why the low carb diet in general help is because when you eat carbohydrate, it doesn't matter how much you eat, but every time you eat carbohydrates, in order for glucose from that carbohydrate, from your blood, to go and enter the cell that it's going to, there are two ways by which it can be transported from the blood to the cells. It can be insulin or sodium transport. And most of the time, it is sodium transport. And when sodium is transporting glucose to the cell is full. Sodium is taking the glucose into the cell against its osmotic gradient. And so it's going to have to squeeze something out of the cell when the glucose enters. And the glucose is also very full of water. A single glucose molecule has six water molecules. So it's a very big molecule. And so as glucose enters the cell, sodium and water exit that cell. So in terms of eating carbohydrates, we are actually causing
sodium depletion.
Depletion of sodium, so hyponatremia, to some degree. And for a non-migraineur, this may not be a complication.
And by the way, this is one of the reasons why people on a keto diet, they just lose tons and tons of water weight.
Exactly. Yeah. They lose a lot of water and salt because insulin holds onto water and salt. Because even if you're using insulin to take the glucose out of the blood and into the cell, that too is still using sodium as assistance to transport the glucose into the cell. So there's no way of avoiding the loss of sodium from the cell when somebody is eating carbohydrates. And you can tell what is happening. I don't know if other people are sensitive to this, but I am extremely sensitive as a migraineur. If I eat a little bit of a carbohydrate, say I eat a single apricot, which is really not much of a carbohydrate if you consider.
Single apricot. Apricot, okay.
Or mm-hmm. any kind of
dried fruit.
Just mm-hmm. a small... Right, which is not too high in carbohydrates. I'm not talking about sugar. Within 5 minutes, I will feel edema building up in my ankles. Within a minute. So it's a near instantaneous. So for migraine brain, it is a lot stronger reaction than for a non-migraine brain. And so we are literally, carbohydrates taking literally sodium and water outside of the place where it should be. And they're causing an electrolyte imbalance as a result. And that then leads to a migraine. because there won't be enough sodium in the place where it needs to be. And there will be too low of water because the water now from our blood went to edema, which is Neverland, and it has to be pulled back in. And so what you're going to find is that when you go on a ketogenic diet, the first thing that's going to happen is, in addition to losing a lot of water and salt as a result of low insulin, you're also pulling a lot of the edema back into the blood to be able to excrete it by the kidneys. So it reduces the edema, it reduces all the stored water wherever it is at, and with that, a lot of sodium will also leave the body. And so the kidneys have this very strong potential to get rid of or excrete waste sodium, but not potassium. So this gets really complicated, and very few people understand that when we're talking about the kidney, the place where the sodium or potassium or magnesium, calcium can excrete via the kidneys is a tubule, the tube that we can visualize as a straw.
Right. They talk about the NAK pumps, which I have some vague recollection of, which are part of the energy metabolism of cells.
Exactly. And so when we're looking at this, just envision for a second a straw, a common straw that you would drink to drink a soft drink. And this straw has a ton of holes in it. So basically, it's a strainer. This tube is a strainer. And the holes can change in size based on dilation or constriction, which the kidney organizes through the RAAS, the renin angiotensin aldosterone system, which then constricts. That will not allow the sodium to leave, just the water, and the sodium gets recycled, which is then what is responsible for hypertension, for example. And so if you're looking at these kidneys, then in order to release potassium, for example, through these tubules, we have to understand that the size of the potassium molecule is much bigger than the sodium.
Okay.
So if we have a dilation of this tubule to allow the potassium to go through, then they're also losing a lot of sodium. And potassium is bigger than magnesium and bigger than calcium. So we're losing everything. If kidneys have to release potassium, they're losing all electrolytes and water. Yeah. But if the kidneys only have to waste sodium, which is its standard baseline state, then none of the others can leave the blood. So the magnesium is recycled, the calcium is recycled, and the potassium is recycled. And so if you're looking at a standard electrolyte panel, the medical doctor, you get to see that continuously, then you can see that the magnesium ranges on the electrolyte panel between 3.5 to 5.2, depending upon what lab one is working, milli equivalent per liter. But in sodium, it's 135 to 150.
So very it's narrow, like 30 narrow range.
Times. Yeah. But sodium is 30 times as much as potassium. And when you're looking at magnesium, it's even less, and calcium is even less than potassium. So we're talking about sodium. We need to have a lot in excess because we will be losing it through the kidneys, excreting, balancing the osmolality.
Well, this is prompting me to pose a lot of follow-up questions. So it's quite fascinating because it's an unconventional approach. It is neither conventional, because we'll talk a little bit about the current raft of new migraine drugs, but it also contrasts with the conventional holistic advice, which is to avoid the migraine trigger foods, to take a lot of magnesium, maybe throw in some feverfew and butterbur. This helps some patients, but is not a slam dunk. So when we return more on the subject of migraine relief, a very novel an exciting new paradigm from today's guest, Dr. Angela Stanton. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.